I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. There's an important book just published this week, Frontier Justice, the Global Refugee Crisis and What to Do About It. Its author, Andy Lamy, joins me now. What he's written is described as a gripping, eye-opening exploration of the refugee crisis. I'm reading the book now, and in some parts it reads like a novel when he talks about the harrowing journey many have to undertake to escape repressive regimes. We'll get Mr. Lamy, who joins me from Toronto this morning, to tell us about the book, the issues, social and otherwise, we all face with regards to accepting and turning away refugees and asylum seekers. Andy Lamy is a journalist and academic whose work has appeared in the National Post, Maclean's, and The Walrus. He's produced documentaries for the CBC's Ideas program. Frontier Justice is published by Doubleday. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Andy Lamy. Good morning, Mr. Lamy.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. I understand you live in Australia.
I do, yeah. I lived in Australia for about 5 years now.
Yeah. Well, what brought you there?
A mix of reasons. One big one was that my wife was offered a job there.
How did they deal with refugees? I think I read about it when we had our little problem here. I shouldn't say little, but we had our own issue with refugees coming in.
It's been changing in recent years, but Australia for a time was famous for having a system of what's called mandatory detention. So anybody who showed up without proper visas would be taken into mandatory detention. So that was probably Australia's greatest claim to fame, or perhaps infamy. That was a sad, tragic system, one that saw men, women, and children incarcerated who had done nothing wrong. In some cases, they were locked up for longer than criminals who had committed serious violent crimes. That generated opposition within Australia, and eventually mandatory detention was removed. In recent years, however, a revised version has been brought back into existence, and as I speak, if you're a woman or a child who comes to Australia, say, by boat, and you don't have proper travel documents, you will be allowed to experience what's called community detention. So you won't be in a prison-like facility. If you are a single man, on the other hand, who arrives that way, then you will be put into mandatory detention. So it's not as bad as it was, say, 10 years ago, but it still is an example of a country that has a harsh attitude towards people who, in many cases, are running for their lives.
And there are still many that attempt to go into Australia, right?
Certainly, Australia, the numbers have not stopped. They certainly went down when mandatory detention was in place, and then after it was abolished, they went up again, and that, the government argues, is why it needs to bring in this revised version. But that's controversial. It exercises very harsh measures on people, many of whom we know are genuine refugees, for the sake of sending a message of unwelcomeness to the countries where they departed from. So certainly it has not been the case that Australia has stopped receiving refugees. It's a permanent fact of political life in Australia, like everywhere else.
And in terms of the numbers, because the subtitle of the book says it's a crisis.
Yeah.
What are the numbers around the world in terms of people that are what are the terms in the book? Internally displaced and forcibly displaced.
Yeah. So distinction involves whether a person has crossed national border or not.
Right.
So this figure changes from year to year. It was even higher in the 1990s, but right now there are estimates saying approximately 9 million people who are refugees of one kind or another. So those would be the ones who have crossed a border after running from persecution. But not everyone manages to make it out of their own country, so you have another category which is known as internally displaced persons. And if you include them in the count, which is reasonable to do because they often are also fleeing persecution, the number goes up to 30 million. But it waxes and wanes depending on how many crisis zones there are in the world at any given time.
And the makings of a crisis, what accounts for that? Is that these conflicts that we see around the world? Is it repressive regimes?
Yeah, there's certainly, there are, you know, crises that produce refugees, there's no question, but the crises that I refer to in the subtitle of my book is one that involves the negative reception that people receive when they travel to Western states and try to make an asylum claim. So if you think of refugees, there's more than one kind. There are those who are stranded in camps in the developing world, and then there are other ones who manage to escape the poor world and make it to places like Canada or Europe or U.S. or Australia, and who arrive here under their own power. So those would be the asylum seekers. The crisis that I refer to is the one of unwelcomeness that is evident in these countries' attitudes. So we live in what's sometimes been called the no-entry age, and measures are put in place to make it difficult for anyone to file an asylum claim. And the rationale for that in the minds of receiving states is to deter people from making weak claims, so people who are economic migrants trying to pass themselves off as refugees. It is a fact of life that there are people who make weak refugee claims around the world, but the measures countries have put in place make it difficult for everyone to file an asylum claim, including genuine refugees. So the crisis is really of one of compounding the situation of bona fide refugees who are often fleeing from persecution only to find that they can't get into places like Canada or Europe, or in the cases of Australia, a second wrong is committed when they are sent to prison for doing nothing wrong.
One of the things that you talk about in the book, and I'm partway through the book, is the media's portrayal of refugees, and that contributing to this unwelcomeness, I guess.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right about that. Refugees set off a strange reaction in the mind of the public. It's a little bit schizophrenic in some ways. Certainly when refugees are portrayed as an undifferentiated mass, you know, this horde of strangers is coming to our shores and what are we going to do at the end of the world, that always triggers panic, anxiety, even xenophobia, sadly. On the other hand, when the media writes about refugees as individuals, when they chart one person's story and really research what they were running from, public will often respond to that in a more sympathetic light. So a lot hangs on how the media frames these issues. I know as a writer myself, there's a famous quotation from Joseph Stalin, of all people, that you may have heard. He says, "One death is a murder, but a million deaths, that's a statistic." And so migration and the borders, these seem to be issues that are very emotional for a lot of people in a negative way. But if you write about one person's journey, then you can hopefully tap into their more humane emotional side.
And in Canada, I guess it was earlier this week, we celebrated Refugee Rights Day. That day, from my understanding, my reading of the book and the materials that your publicist sent, has to do with a decision that was handed down by the Supreme Court 25 years ago or so.
Monday was the 26th anniversary of the Singh decision, which among people who work on refugee issues is memorialized as Refugee Rights Day in Canada. And one of the big issues around the world now is trying to get real, meaningful, powerful laws that enforce the rights of people seeking asylum. That's been a huge, huge challenge, and it's a challenge that most Western states, in fact, have failed to meet. Here in Canada, we certainly have our own problems, but there's nonetheless a foundation of something very good at the heart of Canada's asylum system, and it is the fact that our justice system has recognized that these people have rights, even though they're not citizens of Canada. A lot hangs on that. In Canada, despite our own flaws, we can genuinely say that our Charter of Rights and Freedoms is a document not merely of citizens' rights, but of human rights, and that can make all the difference for people running for their lives.
See, I probably knew that, but it's not something that I thought about, living in Canada, so I guess it's something we all take for granted.
Absolutely. You know, a lot of the thinking around rights, we tend to think of the rights that, say, you and I might have as citizens of Canada. So, you know, if you or I, say, we got in trouble with the law and we needed somebody to defend us, well, we might have a right to a lawyer to argue our case. But there are many countries around the world today where refugees don't even have that much. even though the legal decision, whether to recognize them or send them back, is potentially a matter of life and death. So how far you extend the frontier of rights is a big issue. And the beauty of the Singh decision is in Canada, it extends the frontier to include people who make it to Canada, who need to access the refugee system, and yet are not citizens of our society.
So as a matter of comparison, I guess, are there other countries that do as we do?
There's no other country that, to my knowledge, has recognized precisely the same rights as Canada. One case I talk about quite a bit in the book is Germany, and for a long time it had a constitutional right to asylum, and that right basically said that if you made it to Germany and you're a real refugee, we will grant you asylum here. And there's something noble in that idea, but the way events have unfolded in Germany, I would have to describe the right to asylum as a noble failure. Basically, to kind of compress a lot into a short space of time, Germany puts this clause in its constitution when West Germany is founded in the post-war period. So the German politicians, they look back at Nazi Germany, and they recognize that Germany created a lot of refugees, and they want to, in a way, atone for that past. So that's why they put that clause in there. But then when the Berlin Wall came down 40 years later, the clause contributed to a big crisis in Germany. They never really received that many asylum claims during the Cold War, between World War II and the fall of the Berlin Wall. But once the wall comes down, millions of people from Eastern Europe were free to make asylum claims, and many, many thousands did in Germany, even though most of those claims, we know, were not very strong claims. In other words, these were economic migrants trying to make false refugee claims. And, I mean, it's a long and complicated story, but basically, this asylum clause, which is similar to Canada in being a right that is enforced at the constitutional level, contributes to this crisis in Germany where people come to Germany and file these weak claims, and they had an incentive to do so because the way the law was worded, Germany had to hear all their cases inside Germany. So this vicious circle develops. People start filing weak claims. That lengthens the waiting time. But that makes an incentive for more weak claims to come in, because if you come there, you have to wait for the government to decide your case. Well, maybe could take a few years. That's a few years of working in Germany. So all these claims come in, and the German government responds in the end by gutting their asylum system, changing the constitution, and now Germany has one of the worst, most difficult to access systems out there. So I talk about that case and other ones. That's probably the leading alternative approach that has tried and, in my judgment, has failed. And the strength of the Canadian approach is that it is also constitutional. It also enforces human rights at the highest level of our law. But, as I argue in the book, is less likely to be susceptible to some of the problems that we saw in the German experiment with the right to asylum.
The other argument about accepting refugees is, and we hear this a lot, and maybe this is the media's fault, is that, say our system here in Canada, take that for example, that it could be exploited by terrorists. In your research, is that true?
We do hear that a lot, but I think it's a myth. I heard that when I was writing the book, so I decided to look into it. So I tried to find out exactly how many terrorists have filed refugee claims in Canada. So I used a broad definition, and I included cases not merely of, actual violent extremists, but, say, people who did fundraising for political violent organizations, people who forged passports for them. And if you use that wide definition, I could find 26 cases over a 21-year period in which people who met that definition filed claims in Canada. But the key question really is, okay, what happens next? What if somebody really does try to enter Canada with sinister intentions through the refugee system? And what's striking is how unsuccessful they are. They have an overwhelming failure rate. The most common outcome for somebody who really is affiliated with violence, who makes a refugee claim, is to be subject to what's known as a security certificate. That's a very, very powerful legal tool It's controversial. It allows the government to use measures in court that they would never be able to use against a citizen. But those certificates stop terrorists dead in their tracks. Those who haven't been subject to security certificates have most commonly been deported or arrested. And what's striking about this is the overwhelming failure rate of refugee claimant terrorists is in noticeable contrast to other kinds of cases. So if you think about terrorists coming to North America on, say, student or business visas, like the 9/11 hijackers did, there's a successful case involving student and business cases, student and business visas, that did result in a successful terrorist operation. There's no equivalent involving Canadian refugee claimants. So it's kind of striking in a way. You know, after 9/11, we don't have this big debate, oh, we've got to make student and business visas more difficult to acquire. Instead, we have this debate, we've got to make the refugee system more difficult to access, which has it backwards. And what's, I mean, just to sort of finish up here, and what's even more tragic about this whole refugee terrorist debate is that a lot of the so-called solutions on the security side do take the form of trying to make the system more difficult to access in the name of fighting terror. But what people tragically overlook is that many refugees themselves are running from terror. So we have arrived at the point, sadly, where many people think we can somehow take a stand against terrorism by punishing its victims, by making it more difficult for them to get here and seek safety.
Back to an earlier point where you talked about Canada being this sort of model. I mean, it's not perfect, but it's better than other countries. We're a multicultural society. Is that concept good at, say, integrating the refugee into the society once they...
For me, one of the most... the area where I probably changed my mind was on multiculturalism in the course of writing this book. The first article I ever wrote as a journalist was a long essay on why multiculturalism was a terrible idea. Uh-huh. I've since come to realize, though, that, you know, there are versions of multiculturalism out there that I still think are imperfect or lacking in some way. But whatever flaws multiculturalism may have, it has a huge life and death benefit in that countries that embrace some version of multiculturalism are much more willing to recognize genuine refugees than countries that reject multiculturalism. So the two, you know, examples I talk about in the book will be countries like Germany or Japan. And they have what's sometimes called a descent-based model of belonging. So they don't see themselves as countries of immigration, let alone multiculturalism. And they see membership in their society as something that you inherit from your family. So, you know, if your parents have it, you will have it, even if your family maybe lived abroad for a long time. But if you're, say, a Turkish guest worker living in Germany in the 90s and your grandparents were guest workers, and your parents were guest workers, and you were born in Germany, historically it's been very difficult for those kinds of people to become accepted as members of German society. So if you juxtapose societies with descent-based models of belonging with this more inclusive multicultural model, the great benefit of the multicultural approach is that you have far less anxiety and panic and fear about people arriving at your border wanting to belong. Instead, we can say, okay, we're open in principle to this. Let's start sorting out the real refugees from the others. That's a huge, huge benefit of multiculturalism that is, in my view, radically underappreciated.
We're in the midst of an election campaign in this country, and it's, I mean, this is obviously an important issue. Is this something that you have seen discussed in the campaign thus far, and should it be?
It certainly should be. Unfortunately, the way it is discussed, but in a disappointing way. There's a tendency among politicians in Canada, like so many Western states, to approach the asylum issue entirely in terms of border control. And the issue is always framed in terms of how can we crack down on the border and make it more difficult for quote-unquote bogus refugee claimants to get here. So in Canada, the example right now is the debate around smuggling and making it difficult, if not impossible, for smugglers to bring people here. And I believe the idea is they're going to detain people who arrive via smugglers. There's something very tragically short-sighted about this approach. There's really two things. Briefly, number one, I think it's unrealistic to think that we're ever going to stamp out smuggling. People use the smugglers often because it's their last option. So yeah, I think it's unrealistic to think it's just going to go away. But even if it were to go away, even if Stephen Harper could eliminate human smuggling, what his approach fails to take into account is that often genuine refugees use the smugglers because they have no other option. As I talk about in the book, I give a chapter on the case of an Iraqi man who made it to Australia using the smugglers. Same smugglers later sent out a very, very rickety boat that killed everyone on board, including 14 members of his own family. So certainly there are smugglers out there who are very callous and have a very cynical attitude towards human life. But there are other cases where the smugglers get people there and are chosen in the first place precisely because it's so often so difficult to reach places like Canada due to the policies that the Harper government and other ones put in place. So it's not necessarily wrong in principle to use a smuggler, and I can say this, that if my only way was of saving my life or the life of my family was to use a people smuggler, I would do so in a second.
Andy, this is an important book. We could talk all morning about it. Congratulations on this book. It's a very fine achievement, and good luck with it.
Thanks for your interest.
The book is called Frontier Justice, The Global Refugee Crisis and What to Do About It. It's published by Doubleday. Its author, Andy Lamy, on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plata.